as founders, despite this crazy amount of stress, we can still stay mindful and have good control over like our well-being. I believe that everyone can benefit from therapy, not as a tool of, let's say, depressed or really low to good, but as a tool of excellence. So how can I perform better and discover my maximum?
What makes a brand exceptional?
If you think of it as a DNA, right? So if we take startups, brand is always an extension of founders' DNA and the reason why they created this company. You need to understand why they created it, what's in the DNA, what's in the name, what drives you, what do you want to create in the world? And then you can pack it nicely in a great design and then create the story, right? But it really starts with the...
Tell us more about you and who you are.
I think it actually defines me a lot now, like this level of self-awareness and the big belief in self-awareness and well-being. And I think that it doesn't have to be difficult for people. It just requires a little bit of intention. Maybe that's the right way. Mm. And I understand it can be more difficult for some, less difficult for others. But at the same time, with a little bit of determination and belief that, okay, it's going to work for me, people can actually use it as a tool and learn to use it as a tool. So that defines me a lot. It's like this belief that, okay, you can reframe everything in your mind and that's a good start to actually then have an impact of everything that happens in your life, right? Good, bad things, of course, things happen. Sometimes we cannot influence them, but we can influence how we react to them and how we feel about them, right? And then sit with whatever emotions and feelings are happening and allow ourselves to feel them, right? And it probably takes me to what I'm doing now, the company OMA, and basically the big belief that as founders, like we can, despite this crazy amount of stress and the push and like really stretching ourselves like very far, right? We can still stay mindful and have good control over like our well-being. And then the whole journey throughout like last 15, almost 17 years, it's probably like to some degree connected with self-awareness. Because if you want the story of like my experience, like, so first I was doing design. I started in art school. I was doing design advertising agencies. That was very early days of social media. So
you were also at Saatchi & Saatchi, weren't you?
So I was in an agency which was bought by Saatchi & Saatchi. And then I stayed with Saatchi & Saatchi for a bit. It was the time when there was a lot of the small agencies doing the social media, like mobile websites. Mm. I remember like somebody coming to us and saying, oh, we need to create a mobile website. Like, what is a mobile website? So you can imagine which years it was. It was like a long time ago. And then those small agencies were bought by like bigger agencies were buying smaller agencies to have this capacity of like digital. So I was with one agency, which was bought by Saatchi. Another one was bought by Isobar. And then I changed to the, I got a job offer from a startup, BlaBlaCar. It was my 30th birthday. And I got a phone call from a recruiter. He's like, so this startup is searching for somebody who had their brand department. And my question was, what's a startup? So that was like 8 years ago. And I basically moved to London for this job, and then this whole startup journey started.
What was your first reaction when you heard that blah blah car the brand wants to hire you?
I was like, what? I mean, like, it's not the, if you don't know the brand, and I was like, you know, like full in the agency's world, so we had very big clients. We were, for example, we had Microsoft as a client, we had a lot of alcohol brands, so it was like a completely different world. And then suddenly somebody calls you with this company you've never heard of and says that they are actually in 18 markets. They just raised like tremendous funding round. They have a great team. It's growing super fast. And you're trying like to understand what is actually going on there. And then for me, the biggest, like the reaction was, oh, wow, I didn't even know this kind of companies exist, because I was aware of agencies and I was aware of corporate world. And I was like, hold on a second, like, what are those startups? And that's when I started to explore. I was just never exposed to it.
Before we dive into the world of startups, I'd love to touch on the branding world, which you have so much experience in. couple of agencies, Blah Blah Car, and then also Oyo after that, right? The third largest hotel brand in the world. And then Anchor Store for a little bit, another unicorn. You've had such a amazing level of exposure to big brands and brands on like a very fast scaling journey. So taking a step back and looking at it from a bird's eye view, what makes a brand exceptional?
That's an interesting one. I think it's always the mission behind it. At least I like to believe it. And whenever we're building the brand stories, at least for me, it was always important to understand what actually makes this story. You know, so if we take startups, brand is always an extension of founders' DNA and the reason why they created this company. You cannot like really come and rebrand the company by just repainting the facade, right? You need to understand why they created it, what's in the DNA, what's in the name, what's going on here. And then you can pack it nicely in a great design and then create the story around it, right? But it really starts with the creator. So with startups, it's almost like easier to extract this like brand and the essence because you can speak to founders, right? Which in all three companies I've been working with founders very closely. So that was always important for me to understand their story. And then in the corporate world, back in the agencies, so it was very much like communication. So those were mostly like projects, like advertising projects, right? So they would say like launching new products, right? Or it would be campaigns or like video campaigns, social media accounts management. So then you try to understand, okay, what do they bring to the world? What value do they add to the customer? And then again, like how do you communicate it? And I think there are different approaches, but for me, that's what the brand means. It's like really, it's the reason to tell the story. If that makes sense.
Mm. So you've almost got like the founder-driven story and the culture that's already there within the company. Yeah. You've then got the value that you add to your customers, and you've then got how do you package all of that up together.
That's would be the approach, yeah.
So if a founder wants to do this for themselves, mm-hmm. what questions are they asking themselves to try and uncover their brand and their story?
So they usually have it, right? Because if you, like, let's assume we are talking about founders who fundraised, right? And that's like an easy, like a relatively easy group to refer to, because to fundraise, you need to tell the story. You need to say, okay, why we are doing it? What are you going to do? And convince someone to invest in you doing it, right? So it's no different to the brand story. It's literally when I work with early stage startups, and I still sometimes like do it like more like advisory kind of thing, I'm always like, okay, like show me your pitch deck, right? And then whatever is written there, like what's the mission statement, this actually builds the brand at the early stage, right? And then before that, before first fundraising, when you're still thinking, okay, I want to create the company and you have an idea, it's like, okay, what drives you for this idea? What do you want to create in the world, right? And sometimes even if it's a company, like let's say something which is maybe seems to not be very mission driven, right? Let's take something, you know, like an accounting software, right? Great business can be built out of it. But at the same time, people may be like, oh, that's not really like a brand. But well, if you think of it, you are making life of many people easier by building this software. You can always have a good reason why you are doing it, right? Even if it's just like, okay, it's a good business. Well, maybe you are multiplying somebody else's business. And that's already a good reason to have the mission behind it, right? And then if you are able to extract that, from this the brand can be built. And then in later stages, it's I think it depends on like what the company does, because at some point, for example, Oyo had this, right? We had in Southeast Asia, we had 19 brands. There were hotels, they had homes, cloud kitchens, they had offices as well in India. So you need to like really understand like, okay, what are we building the brand for, right? So is it like a single, for example, single hotel brand? It's like, okay, is it like for a specific group of people, this type of a hotel or the other? Or is it the brand of the whole company, like kind of like umbrella thing all around, right? So that's basically the thinking.
What is it, a house of brands or a branded house?
Yeah.
And so then what do companies need for their brand depending on the stage? Because I'm assuming the type of brand work that a pre-seed founder is doing is not the same as a Series B, C, D founder.
Yeah, I totally agree with this. It's not the same. I think it's at this very early stage, you can really create it on your own, right? Like unless you are building a consumer product, let's say like an actual product, right? Like a candles brand. Okay, that's like design heavy. There needs to be a concept behind and you need to invest in the design. But at the same time, for most companies, like especially tech companies, this initial brand is literally what you're pitching, right? It's like, okay, what do I do? Why do I do it? And then have some like reasonably aesthetic packaging of it in the logo, like website, like an app, like whatever you do. And it's almost like functionality is more important. So let's say if you're building an app, I would put much more attention, like pay much more attention to the user experience than the branding of it, right? Because how the users will be using it, like how comfortable they will be with this product, how good it will be, that will then create the whole like brand affinity, right? And then at the later stages, so it's like, it's almost like I would be very, like, I would discourage people to invest a lot in the branding at the very early stage, right? It should be something, it can almost like be like a Canva template kind of thing. And then when you start to have your product market fit and you see what's actually working, what do people want, what you're building, that's when you're like, okay, there will be a moment when you need to invest a little bit in this brand, because maybe whatever you created earlier, like from, let's say, templates, is not going to take it further, right? Because you need to make it like a little bit more unique, build a bit of the story. And that's when you probably take the either consultant or the agency to do it for you.
Gotcha.
That's what I would always say. That's usually like around like Series B-ish, like sometimes a little bit earlier with consumer products. That's my experience.
And so the process of scaling a brand, I'm assuming that's just a series of revisions. What is brand work that happens later on versus at the start? Like how does the brand evolve, or how should the brand evolve?
I think it's again, like if you think of it as a DNA, right? So let's take the linear journey of like, okay, you build something based on your own designs, or somebody did it for you, maybe a friend, or like you took some templates. At some point you do the rebrand, you do this like proper like design, let's say logo, right? Or like something that you really want to exist and be as a signature for the brand. And then from that, like you have probably like you went through the thinking about how the story should be told, right? As part of the exercise of the rebranding. And it's like, okay, what's this one line? Like why do we exist? Which usually is more like taking all the information and just like packing them in the right way and like extracting this one thing. And then from that, you deliver the story throughout all the communication, right? So the stronger the strategy was created at this key moment is created, the better this and the easier it will be to tell the story in the future. And then I think it can, you know, if it's done well and you are still building the same thing after, let's say, 10 years, can still last. Like look at Airbnb, right? It's my absolutely favorite example, of course. Company built by designers, right? Yeah. And we actually in BlaBlaCar, we worked with the agency who did Airbnb branding. So, I could see the process. It was 2016,
okay.
Right? When we worked 2016, 17, when we worked with them, we were branded BlaBlaCar with them, Koto agency. And they were working on Airbnb rebranding when they did this like logo, like, which we all
beautiful.
Know. So, the reason I'm talking about this is because it was interesting when they were talking where the belonging came from. And it was as part of, and I don't know if they say it on the record, so you will need to check it later.
Yeah.
But it was part of the interviews with the employees. So typically an agency, and I work the same way if I work on branding, you would go to the company and talk to 5-6 key people, founders, of course. But then you would ask like, okay, can I speak to the customer service person? Can I speak to one of your engineers to a little bit like get a little bit of understanding what's the company about. And apparently the belong anywhere actually came up in the interviews with one of the engineers or someone like in the technical team when they said, you know, it's as if you actually like belonged anywhere. And they just like liked it so much. Everyone loved it. And it became the like claim for the whole brand. and somebody who, it's only the person who is inside with the company for a very long time, or like who understands like what's going on, like who can actually extract something like this. Nobody external will ever come and say, okay, this is about Belong Anywhere. Nobody is able, like it's rare, like extremely rare to do it in a way which will not feel artificial.
Moving on from branding, would love to know about the hiring journeys that you've been on within these scale-ups, because that is usually one of the most challenging things for scale-ups, is how do you find the right people, get them all in such that you don't miss out on this opportunity for growth. What has been your hiring experiences in each of these companies, and does any single experience stand out as being a big learning curve?
I think it's a very interesting question and very long answer. I think, so I was always in charge of building the brand teams, so I can talk to that. And maybe from the beginning, if we take BlaBlaCar, it was actually my first experience as a manager and that person to hire people. So of course, like a huge learning curve. And on top of that, I just moved from Poland to the UK. So as much as I worked with international companies before, I haven't been working in a different country. So it was the first time when I had to learn, like, okay, what's the culture of hiring actually? How do people normally do it in this industry of startups in this country? They were a French company, so we had headquarters in Paris. I would spend a lot of time there. So I had to like pretty quickly like understand all those countries. It was hard. Hard on a probably more like personal level to find myself in like such a like unfamiliar environment in a company which is growing so fast, right? But we were hiring designers at that time in different countries. The setup was we had designers in 7 countries. So again, like, yes, the technology helps, like you can interview them remotely, but then you need to understand the context of what is the design ecosystem that they're coming from. Do you want in this country to hire from advertising agencies, or in that country maybe you want to hire from corporate world because the cultures are different, the speed of working is different. But I think we managed to build like a really great team. And then unfortunately towards the end, we were shutting down the office here in London. The majority of the brand team was here. We're shutting down the office here, and people who were in this office actually were not relocating. So it was like pretty horrible experience when I had to let go almost my half team, like more than half of my team in one day. And again, as a first time manager, like you are like, nothing prepares you for this, right? In a startup, like everyone is speeding, everyone is like figuring out things. And I'm pretty sure I messed up like so many things there, but it's a learning, right? And then after BlaBlaCar, I was in my yoga journey for like half a year. So it changed me hugely, like it's almost like changed me as a person, right? And my approach like to hiring people, how I work with people, how I manage people and so on, to the degree that at some point when I was working in Anchor Store, which was a French company as well, person who knew, like we were kind of connected through BlaBlaCar, and they actually came to me and they were like, can I ask you something? Like, really, like, sorry for asking this, but I really want to know. Because I've heard so many things about how harsh you are, like how, like, you know, difficult it's to work with you and so on. And I see the opposite, which I took as a compliment. And I was like, he was like, how did it happen? And what's going on here? And I was like, well, look, like I went through like half a year of like mindfulness and like really deep dive into myself. And I unlearned some patterns and learned new ones. And I just changed. And like I changed like significantly, like as the person, as a manager in the BlaBlaCar, and everything after, it's like a different person. So talking about hiring, the next thing was the work which I was doing with Oyo, which was an Indian company. So I joined them after Series E from SoftBank. This was 1 billion, like a huge round, great time. It was 2018, mid 2018. If I remember well, and that was the time when WeWork was at the high, like SoftBank was like, there's lots of great press and they were building these amazing things, like investing crazy amounts of money in the companies. And I was working with Oyo, mostly in India, traveling Southeast Asia, the time before like remote work. So we were doing everything in person. And then, of course, like cross countries, like remotely, very interesting. And then I had to hire the team in a completely different culture. So again, it was like unlearn everything that you learned about hiring, because things work differently here. And I remember on one interview, so I had the team of 50 people in Oyo, which I built. So when I came, the brand team was 12, and we had to restructure it a little bit. And then at the end, it was 50 when I was leaving, 50. And we had designers, social media people, video producers, but also interior designers, because it was a hotel brand, right? And I remember at some point when I was interviewing people, I was like, why is everyone so well, you know, outspoken? Like, they are presenting themselves so well, which I haven't seen in Europe that much. I mean, like, people can present themselves, but in India, it was just like a next level. It's like they were great in presenting themselves. And I remember one person there, like I think it was, he was a regional manager for Mumbai or like one of the areas. He answered this question for me. He was like, look at the street here. There's just so many people. Like, if you want to cross the street from one side to another, you need to be extremely confident, because you just need to go like this. And it's the same, like when you're driving, you just need to go like this. And he's like, that's exactly what people are learning at school, at work, and everywhere, that you need to find your way to be the first and really like to present yourself really well, because otherwise there's so many people who are candidates and who may be as smart. You just need to nail this skill. And they were just so very good in it. So that's when I had to learn that, okay, you need to like scratch under the surface and see what's behind the person presenting themselves and what's actually happening in their experience, and like do a very different process of hiring than I would do here, for example, which was like huge discovery for me, very interesting. And then the other thing was the culture in Southeast Asia, in India, was so different than the culture that I was familiar here with here, that again, I was like, oh, wow, like things are not done the same here, and things which are just normal and everyday life looks like this, is very different in India than here in Europe. And that's, for example, like unrelated to hiring, or even like maybe we take example of like a work. There was someone working for me and I got an invitation to her wedding. Mm. And I maybe spoke to this person once or twice. And I'm like, I didn't even like understand why and like how, right? But she just came and handed it to me. And I was like, okay, so my partner at that time was Indian, and I asked him, I was like, tell me, like, what is it? And he's like, that's the culture. Like, it's normal that the weddings are so big and you invite people who are like who you work with. And he just like explained it to me, that this is just the way it's done here, and you don't have to accept it if you cannot be there, because I wasn't in the country at that time. But it's just absolutely normal and okay that somebody would do this, which is again, like, it's like, if we think of it, like if you, it's after mm-hmm. the conversation, like 5 months later, you invite me to your wedding, I would be like, oh, we are not really that good friends, right? But then you go like in a different country and it's like, well, it's normal, right? Yeah. It's the same like things like arranged marriages, which is like not related to work. And again, it's just normal and it actually works. So I quite regret that we don't have it in Europe, because people would be very happy if they had this hope from their parents.
We can definitely circle back on arranged marriages. But before then, I'd love to know how you would approach scaling internationally yeah. and preparing the company to evolve to a new culture.
Mm-hmm.
What are you thinking about in terms of building an office internationally? Yeah. Before you jump into it?
I think, and I can only talk from what I learned in the companies where I worked, China is actually a very good example. So Oyo had a huge business in China and they were very successful. Like, it was a successful business. Very different to, I think, Uber, when they tried to build in China, they didn't really succeed. And many companies tried. What Oyo has done well is that they hired like completely local team, because they said, look, back to the culture, right? The culture is just so strong here so specific that we need people who know this culture to build it. And then is the question, okay, how do we mix this culture with the company culture, right? And I think the best practices, which I've seen, which how I would approach it, is first of all, you establish, okay, depends on which market it is, right? If it's a market which is quite similar to the market, like culturally, and culturally, I mean, like, how are people raised? What's the education, right? Like, what are the relations between people? How they do business? How they buy things? Those things, if they are quite similar between countries, you can probably rely on the same consumer habits and, like, users. If they are very different, it should be a different approach. So let's say we are opening Germany, right? Or we are opening France. Well, you probably is quite homogeneous, like, as Europe. Of course, specific cultures are different, like, in terms of... French and German are just different, right? But let's say you have a very strong company culture, right? So I would definitely take somebody from the existing team to actually launch it. Like, it's almost like, I think every company where I worked, there was a country launcher position. So the person, whenever we were launching a country, like BlaBlaCar had it, we were launching the country, would have one person from the existing team dedicated to be the launcher. They would stay there for, let's say, a year, and they would make sure that the whatever is there is actually, like, in line with the company processes, culture, like habits, meetings, like how we do things. And it can be one person, it can be a group of people. Airbnb was scaling this way. They were, like, sending people from their existing team, I think, to other countries. And then the other way is, like, if you buy a company, like, from another country, it's, like, a completely different story, right? And then the other, if you're, like, going to the country which has a very strong culture, it's easier to have this person coming from the company, but then relying on the ecosystem there and just, like, employing people there locally, right? So, for example, Oyo had a very strong business in Japan, and I remember the team in Tokyo. So there was one person from Oyo India team who went there, and there were a few people, like, were helping in hiring, but the core of the team was very, very local. And they just knew the market, they knew the habits. Japan culture is, like, how they were doing, like, hospitality, like rentals. It was just very, very specific. So they had all this knowledge. And then what the team from India was bringing in there, like, was more like a company processes, like, culture.
This is interesting. I love that you mentioned Japan, because in Yvon Chouinard, the founder of Patagonia, he speaks in his book a lot about their move into Japan and how, I think, when they tried, almost every country did it as a joint partnership, joint venture with a Japanese company, because almost every Western company didn't meet the standards of the Japanese people. And so lots of them didn't succeed. Patagonia did manage to do it themselves, but they said that just the buying habits of someone in Japan is so different, in that people would go into a clothing shop and they would pick up 10 of the same t-shirt to try and find which t-shirt was the highest quality or, like, the best, most well-made, which is, like, a kind of different mentality.
Yeah, I think, you know, it comes down to respect. It's like when you, I now thought of it, and I think that maybe true. It's like when you build something, you have a company which is working, right? And you want to open a new market. So you want to offer something, you see the business opportunity there. And then you have to be respectful to people who are going to buy it or use it, right? So now if you understand their habits well, you can try to figure it out. But if you don't understand their habits, well, you need to find someone who does and informs you about it, because otherwise you're going to fail. And I think there's something very similar to hiring people. It's like, how do you hire people? Especially, like, in our case, like, brand teams. So other than, like, technical things, for example... I think it was in one of the agencies where I worked, where we're working for Egypt? Yeah, we were doing some, like, campaign in Cairo. For whatever reason, like, Polish team was doing it was Procter & Gamble campaign.
Lots of Polish people in Egypt then.
Right. Yeah. In 90s, like, no, early 2000. But we're doing something. And I was just a designer. And then they say, no, you need to take this translation to Arabic language and put it on your designs. And for me, like, suddenly I have a font with like a 5 different like types of Arabic language. And I'm like, I have no idea how to do it. What's more, like, it needs to go the other way. So just such a simple thing, right? Requires some knowledge of what's going on actually in the culture. And this is like very much on the technical level. But then if you think of it on the like more like messaging, like what should be on the picture, what shouldn't be on the picture, like how to do the message, how to do the positioning of the brand, what should the brand be about, what's important for people who are actually receiving this brand, you really need this local expertise very often. It's like just a detail quick thing.
The thing that's coming to mind with that links these two is this notion of stories. You spoke about it a lot when it's like your brand story, how well can you tell your story, the story of the company. But this then also feels like culture is also just a story. It's what story a group of people have been telling themselves and living by. So have you thought about how you break down stories or how you craft a really compelling one?
So you mean like how do you craft the story? Like how do you craft the mission?
I think so. It feels like that's the most leveraged thing that people can improve on. So if you have a really, really compelling mission or vision or purpose, then you'll use that in your brand communications. Yeah. You'll use that in your marketing. You'll use that in your hiring. You'll use that in your culture setting.
Mm-hmm. So you can think of it in a few ways, right? What makes a good story, right? So one thing is like, what do you put in the story? But then what people hear, right? So you need to communicate it in a way which is appealing to people. So it's the same like with the company mission. You can decide on your company mission and say, okay, this is what we're going to do, this is why. But if you're not able to articulate it, it's just not going to work. Because you're going to go to someone, they're going to be like, yeah, whatever. If you hear the whatever, that means you need to readjust, right? Like what you're saying, right? And I think that's the same thing about the brands. How do you make people care about your story? Or sometimes, if you don't want them to care, how do you make the story transparent for whatever reason, right? Sometimes you may want to have like a background story, right? And which is rarely with the brand, but it can be the case with the brand sometimes. And I probably will not have an example now. But let's take hospitality is a good example. Like you take a hotel, you go to the hotel, you want your experience to be part of the story and not the brand, right? Let's take W Hotels, right?
Yeah.
It's like a very strong brand. It's like you walk into a W Hotel, like you know exactly you're in the W Hotel, right? But in the same time, you want to be part of the story. You want this experience to be created for you. You want it to be functional. You want to have the room which is like nicely designed and comfortable for you, and you don't want the brand to shout at you and be like in your face, like more than your experience. Does it make sense?
Of course.
So that's what I mean, like as a transparent story. It's like, can you build the story which almost blends with the person who's listening to this story? And then you can have another brand which is much more like we can take like any consumer brand, like clothes, for example, right? You may want to actually show this brand a little bit more because this brand is a statement, right? So it's almost like comes down to like being aware of what are you creating the story for, who is listening to the story, and who is going to tell this story for you, if that makes sense.
So much sense. That is very well articulated. I love that. Cool. Speaking of stories, you have now started a very timely and impactful company called Oma. What is your story behind Oma? How did you come to founding it?
So basically, Oma has like two chapters. The company was called Wanji before. And those are two names of my grandmothers connected. And the story was, because when you have a problem, you go to your grandparents, right?
Mm.
That's what we all do. Like if we have the luxury of going to our grandparents, they don't judge us. They will give us a little bit of advice and say like, keep going, you can do it, right? And that's what we all want. And I actually came up with the name. It was quite random. It was during COVID. And I came out with 1G, and I was like, oh, that's a good name of, like, for like what we are building. I registered the company because there's Hill of 1G in north of England, okay. And there was nothing else. It was like, great for Google, like positioning is gonna work. And the problem was nobody could actually write it or spell it when I was saying it. Because if I say 1G to you, if you are French, you are probably gonna write OUA, 1G.
Yeah.
I had somebody in Spain write it 1G. And I was like, okay, I need to find something simpler because it's just very difficult to communicate it. And then a friend of mine suggested the name Oma. Just completely randomly, like in a conversation, she was like, you should call your company Oma. I was like, yeah, that's a good idea. And Oma actually means grandma in some languages.
Yeah.
And it's a very simple word.
Yeah.
And it's, then I asked a few people, a friend of mine, maybe not a friend, but person who I used to work with, and he has one of the best branding agencies in the world, Collins.
Okay.
Brian Collins. So I worked with him on Oyo, and I was talking to him about Oma rebranding, and I said, like, what do you think about the name Oma? He's like, first reaction is the sound of the universe, like Om. And I was like, okay, if he says that, it's gonna stay. So it was like it was pretty like valid, like great validation, right? And Brian is a great person, like, and he knows what he's doing, of course. So it was quite powerful. But anyways, like, that's the name of the company, and then we created it. So when I was 17, my youngest sister had a brain tumor. Like, she had a surgery. It was like quite sudden. Nobody knew what's going on. And she went to the US to have a surgery and came back. Everything is okay. Now she has a beautiful daughter who is 1.5 year old, great husband, like great family. She's a very happy person 20 years later. Amazing. But at that time, I was like, you know, in Poland in like 90s, like no internet, maybe a little bit of internet. Like, we didn't have the technology we have now. We didn't have, like, forget about, like, psychology. Nobody knew what it is about. And I remember at that time when we had those news, my parents went with her to the surgery, and me and my other sisters, we just had so many questions, right? Like, about, like, what to do, like, what's going on. And there was no guidance from anyone. My grandma was with us at that time. But there was no guidance from anyone about, like, how to process this whole thing, right? And it's not because of, like, it's not my parents' fault, but it's because the whole, like, system at that time just looked like this. Mm-hmm. And even when I talked to my mom about, so my sister was 9 at that time, when she had the surgery, she's like, there was no psychologist who would come and ask. Like, they would come, like, once a week to check on all the kids in the whole hospital, right? And it was just no, like, habit of, like, doing, like, anything on mental health. And back then, I remember when my parents came back, there were so many other parents calling my mom and saying, we just learned that our kid has a cancer or, like, some other things. And there were parents literally communicating with each other about, like, giving each other advice. And at that time, I was like, why there's no system which allows those people to exchange advice and ask those questions? And then we are 20 years later, it's COVID. So at that time, I had, for a short period of time, I had an advertising agency with my ex-partner, where we were connecting brands and production studios from around the world. Because there's, like, actually a very big price difference when you look at different countries in terms of the production of the videos and, like, branding. It's all other story. I always had this thing about, like, connecting things, you know, like, globally. Mm. And what I saw, because I was leading brand teams globally, I could see, like, okay, for example, we do this in Germany, do this in Poland, do that in the US. And it's, like, unexpected. It's just so much cheaper here and it's so much more expensive. And it's, like, even, like, a CGI image, like, let's say, like, CGI of a hotel, you know what it is, right? Like a 3D, could cost £700 in one country and $3,000 in another country. And similar quality image. And actually, at some point, did the test. It came back as a result and I was like, this looks the same, but the price is like X times, right? Very interesting stuff. But I had that. And at that time, when COVID started, I had one employee working with us. So we just literally had the first client, first contract. We started working on things. And then COVID hit. So, of course, nobody was investing in advertising. Like, we were in lockdown. My whole, like, private story, like, changed because we were in long distance. So we, of course, you cannot, like, have a long distance relationship in COVID, in lockdown. Mm. It doesn't work. But the employee who I had, like, I didn't want to let him go. And he just, like, kept asking me, like, okay, what do I do next? And I had this idea of, like, connecting people with therapists or, like, people who can help mental, like, in mental health support. I was like, you know what? I had this idea back then, and he knew the story of, like, my sister. Why don't you research some companies which do mental health, like, remotely? And he just, like, kept coming back with the research, like, every other day and kept asking me, okay, what do I do next? And because whatever he was bringing was actually, like, more and more interesting for me, and I was like, hold on a second, there's something going on here. So that's when I said, like, okay, we should build a platform which allows you to ask questions to therapists without commitment to therapy. And that was the initial idea of Oma Wanji at that time. We had three therapists working with us. They were volunteering. I basically invested my own money to build it. And we're doing things like ask anything to trauma therapists anonymously in the app. For example, like today at 5 p.m., right? And we had therapists responding. And we were promoting it on, like, Discords of the world, like, you know, like those kind of channels. It wasn't huge. I didn't really, like, at that time, I didn't expect it's going to be, like, a big company or anything like this. We're just doing it because I thought it was valuable, important. And, you know, during COVID, we all wanted to do something, right? We were quite a lot of time. And that was when I left Oyo. So I wasn't traveling. I didn't have my full-time job at that time. I was just after having this, like, first iterations with my ex-partner, like, about the agency. So that was the story. But then the most recent part of the story is that we had this platform where you could ask anything to the therapist anonymously, and I couldn't find the commercial model for it. So when I was working with Anchor Store, actually I had a conversation with one of the founders about, like, okay, what could it be? And he suggested, like, it's a marketplace. First of all, like, I was working with marketplaces for many years, so I knew the dynamics of building the marketplace. And the second of all, it just made sense as a marketplace. And then when he said it, I was like, okay, I know what it should be. And then from that, I decided, like, okay, I'm going to build it. We did some changes, like, to the technology. We raised money last year. And that's how the whole ecosystem Enoma was created. It's like a platform where you can match with therapists successfully. It can be real time. It can be added scheduling at some point. But we really focus on, like, making sure that, like, you're matching with someone now, like, whenever you need. And it's a successful match and not, like, a random thing among, like, 30,000 other therapists. So that's the story. I think I just went, like, really far from your original question.
Beautiful meander. What defines a successful match with a therapist? If you have a founder listening to this now and they're like, I'm thinking about therapy, how do they find the right therapist for them?
That's the question which I don't have an answer for. So the truth is, that's the work we are doing, actually. It's like, when you look at the therapy in general, what defines actually a successful match later on is the therapeutic alliance, right? So it's like, how well do you connect with your therapist, how well you trust this therapist, and how good bond you manage to build in a healthy way, of course, right? And it's easier to see when it is good and when it exists. It's much more difficult to see, like, okay, what's going to actually, what are the things that can help to predict, is it going to be a good match? So that's what we are searching in the technology which we want to build. Is like, one thing is the expertise and expectations to the therapist from the client. The other thing will be the therapist's ability to understand this client, right? And then we should remember therapists are only human. They sometimes have a bad day. Sometimes they have, maybe they don't understand the thing that you're working on. Sometimes they may have difficult things going on in their lives and they still need to do their job. So of course, this whole thing is a factor as well. But they also don't want to put too much of themselves into the therapy room, right? Because they can't. Like, imagine, like, you have 8 people, like, talking to you about their problems, you cannot really, like, let them take part of you, right? So that's the difficulty, because as a client, let's say you want to speak with a therapist who is a parent, right? Because maybe you have small children. And as a therapist, you really don't want somebody to know and have any like connection to the fact that you have small children. It's like your private life. So that, I think that's the difficulty in matching. And then I think what can make it successful if that's something which is happening in the background. So let's say in the matching system, this information is provided, but the part of the algorithm like recognizes this kind of things, but then it's not the reason why those people match. It's just one of the many ingredients. Does it make sense? Mm. So I don't yet know what should be this algorithm, but there will be things like experiences, like the how fast somebody is talking, right? Like how warm the person is, how cold the person is, how much of like a motivation do they give you, and versus how much are they more passive, right? There are like different dynamics like with different people, and I tested a lot of therapists last year, and like I just wanted to see what are the dynamics with different therapists. And tested is not a nice word, but this is what it was actually, because I wanted to see the experience with multiple people. And it's really interesting to see how much the person actually brings to the room, right? As much as they want it to be their job, but their personality is very visible in it. And I think there's something interesting to be built around kind of like protecting therapists from using too much of this like personality thing there, but in the same time, using those information to create a successful matching. And then, of course, it's not discussed in the room, but it's like, it's almost similar. Like, imagine you have two friends who don't know each other, and you're like, oh my God, those people will love talking to each other. And you just match them together. Maybe not as a couple, they may be completely different dynamics. But sometimes you just see those people will just enjoy the conversation together. And I think something similar should be happening in the room with the therapist matching. Mm. And I may not be clinically correct here, but from everything I've seen, big part of the therapeutic alliance will be the personality of the therapist as well as the client expectations, like understanding those expectations, understanding of the topic. So we've done the survey on founders. We asked them, what do they think it's important for the therapist to understand the nature of their job? And majority of founders say yes, right? Then we ask the same question to therapists and they say no, because they say every human is the same. And you're like, but the client comes to you with the expectation that you will understand it, right? So that's where the friction is, I think.
And so then Wanji started as focusing on teenagers. Yeah. I'm assuming that was just born directly out of your sister's experience.
To some degree, yeah.
To some degree. And then it pivoted to founders.
So we started like as a platform for students.
Yeah.
So I was searching, okay, which audience is the first one to focus on, right? I knew that if we succeed with the platform, which gives like, first of all, real-time matching, and second of all, something which is much more like casual than like a big commitment. It can be a big commitment, but can also be something more like encouraging to take a maybe big commitment later. And I was searching who is the first audience who may need it the most. And when we came across conversations with students, we saw that they had very long waiting times. The mental health conditions among students and adolescents are like more and more visible. They need more and more help. And we got a lot of we had a lot of conversations with therapists who work with students. And they were telling us, look, we see like a huge change, even compared to last like 2-3 years before, in how much more depressed, anxious, unhappy, like low self-confidence the students are, right? And then it was going towards the self-harm and like really like horrible things. So I was like, okay, let's look into this group. We looked at the support that students get in the universities, and occurred that they actually go through like a quite a complex process where they go through the assessment. And then after about a month, there's another assessment if they still need it. If they qualify, they receive 6 counseling sessions and then goes to NHS, like if there's still the need, right? And this process itself, it was like, it's not really a fit to like a student's lifestyle now, right? You open your phone, everything is here now. you're not waiting a month for your assessment, like mental health support. So I thought it's going to be interesting group to help. But then when we started going into the universities, it was quite slow in terms of bringing the solution there officially, having the, for example, the university to pay for students support or connected with the whole ecosystem. And I think I didn't know how to do it, but also the deeper I was going into the like whole like education system in the UK, and I studied in Poland, so I didn't know it very well. I was like, okay, I need to become an expert in it to actually bring this solution to the students. And I didn't want to build an edtech company. I wanted to build a mental health support well-being platform. So we were like, okay, maybe we still like, of course, like students can use it if they want to, but rather than trying to make it part of the system, we're going to look at other groups. And then we looked at direct customer. So we just literally opened it for everyone. I mean, it was open for everyone. We just started promoting it for everyone. And we started to see like very different clients coming to us. And then towards end of the year, when I was looking, okay, what are the similarities of the clients who stay, come back and use the platform? Those were like all people like from very different backgrounds. So again, it was a question like, okay, how do we narrow down the focus? And because again, like over the last, let's say 18 months, I was talking a lot to different, to founders, to investors, different networking events, founders who build like amazing companies, people who can almost like afford everything and like money is not a problem. There was always the same question coming back. It's like, do you have a therapist who can see my daughter, who can see the founders, who can potentially help me with this? People were like really opening up because they knew what we are doing. And because I saw the problem in the industry, I was like, okay, so first of all, we can, this group can afford it, right? Of course, founders at the early stage maybe cannot, but the investors have an interest in founders performing well. So can they encourage founders to either make it a business expense or cover it for them? And the second thing was, it's quite a homogeneous group, because then we can go into the research on the conditions of founders and like basically psychology of founders. It's quite homogeneous and it can be quite similar. And then when I looked at the therapist, there was a group of therapists among the therapists we were working with who actually either worked with founders or had business background from before. So we had therapists who were in VC before and then became a therapist, or like we have one therapist who was a lawyer in, I think she was in early days of eBay for 7 years. She was in legal team there. Then she built her own business. Then she became a therapist. It's like, how great understanding of founders' journey can this person have, right? Mm. And because we had these people at the table, I was like, okay, let's just focus on founders. And of course, I feel very strong about this group of people. And I think it's almost like the impact where we find the way to help founders is like a double impact, because those are people who are building great things in the world, right? And they need help. So that's the story.
I'd love to go into the psychology of founders and what's characteristics are common.
Yeah, so it's something which is interesting work from Dr. Freeman, which I mentioned to you earlier. He's doing a lot of research on founders, psychology, on the psychiatric conditions, and he is one of the people in the world to talk about the similarities, right? About like how much founder psychology and psychiatry is different than general population. If you know a lot of founders who are, and I'm talking about people who are committed to build things rather than people who think about building things are not sure yet to build it, right? It's like a very different stage in building a company when you already get the first funding and you are like on the journey under the pressure and you're building it, right? So that's the group of people I'm talking about. You see how different they are. The drive is different. Where do they get their motivation from? Why do they live this crazy life of, I'm going to make like my life like super hard for the next 10 years and build something rather than go to and get like maybe like a job which will pay me salary and so on. And there's a lot that people sacrifice. And of course, there are other jobs that do it, like take, I don't know, firefighters, right? They have like incredible like responsibility, and they also like are big risk takers. But specifically founders, it is about the risk taking. It is about the, I think Dr. Freeman calls it high dopamine personalities, high dopaminogenic personality, that's the word. And it's about, the question is like, are those conditions something that drives founders and that can characterize somebody who can be successful as an entrepreneur? And if that's the case, how can you support those people? Because then the fact that if we take bipolar ADHD, right? Those conditions can have like huge, like crazy highs and extreme creativity, but then it's balanced with like very big lows, right? Or like difficulty with processing certain things. So one thing, of course, there's like a medication that can help in it. There's like certain chemical things happening in the brain, which I'm completely out of my depth discussing because I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist. But there's also this mental health support of like talking to someone who understands this group of people through therapy or through like a general like counseling, mental health advisory, coaching, and getting it like as a quality, as a quality service. And then the next thing is the unique founder psychology needs to be understood by the therapist you're going to. Right. So if you take a founder who has those, let's say it's like has very specific like psychiatric conditions and is building something amazing and just like decided to like just completely sacrifice the next like 10 years of their life to build it. And they say, okay, I need therapy because I'm really low, like in different moments. And they go to a therapist like in just like regular clinic. A likelihood that they will find a therapist who actually understands what they're going through is low. And things which I've heard from founders going through this kind of situations was like, oh, you know, this therapist told me that maybe I should change my lifestyle, or they questioned, why do I do it? Or they completely didn't understand that I have this drive and I cannot help it. Or they told me my standards are too high and I need to like just calm down a little bit. And you hear this kind of things and you're like, yeah, I can totally see it, because you need to understand, you go to a therapist who maybe never came across startups or people who build startups or people who have this like incredible personality of like just building things and like driving stuff. And they're just not familiar with it. And they are operating in the, you know, like they have tools that they know how to use. And they say, okay, I know that 90% of people who come to me get better after this and this and that changes they make in their lives and psychology. So maybe you should try as well. And then you're like, no. So it's like there's like a lot of this tension about like the uniqueness of this like small percentage of people in the world.
And within that founder subset of people who need therapy, is there a specific type of founder who is more prone to anxiety, depression, other mental illnesses?
I think, you know, from what I've seen, so first of all, I've never met a successful founder, and I'm talking people who sold their companies or built like billion-dollar businesses. Maybe very few, but no, actually, I've never met a person who would tell me, who wouldn't tell me when asked like about like mental health, that at some point they didn't have to work on their own mental health and psychology. Different ways, right? But even when you take... there's this book, Hard Think About Hard Things.
Ben Horowitz.
You know what he says? Like, it's the hardest thing was managing my own psychology. And that's what I have seen among like all the founders like who are successful. And they will not admit it very often, but you can see that, okay, at some point of their journey, own psychology was the biggest thing that they had to get over. Because you can have things that hold you back. You can have things that, for example, my if I talk about my own example, the culture in which I was raised, in Poland, I was like naturally raised like super shy. Like you shouldn't like almost like stand out, right? Like from the crowd. It's good to be like altruistic. You need to give back. And then if we take I was born like in 85, which was like still the communism in Poland. So I remember those years. So again, like the dynamics of the communism were people who were wealthy and very like, you know, visible. There were usually people who were perceived as like there's something negative in their journey, right? And that was the political system, right? For whatever reason, like that was perceived this way. So now like you learn all of that as like until like 6 years old, like you're a lot of things are shaped in your brain and your personality subconsciously. And then you repeat those patterns as an adult and now try to build the company and pitch investors if you cannot like really claim that you want to be successful and build something extremely successful. So if we recognize this kind of small things in our personality, I believe that everyone can benefit from therapy, not as a tool of from, let's say, depressed or really low to good, but as a tool of excellence, right? So how can I perform better and discover my maximum like capacity and like remove all the blockers, or at least know how to manage them using therapy for my benefit? And I think that's the biggest like mission of what we want to do is like, when you match with the right person, then it's like, can you actually use therapy as your tool of excellence? And it's not the tool for like curing the illness, if that makes sense. Mm.
I talk about therapy and coaching in terms of connecting with myself. And my whole mission is around helping people better connect. And I believe that we are limited by how much we can connect with other people, by how much we've connected with ourselves. And so therapy and coaching is that work around connecting with ourselves, which then unlocks this potential to connect with other people, which sounds similar, right, to what you were saying in terms of, as opposed to taking away from a negative, it's amplifying your excellence, amplifying this positive.
Yeah. The way I understand what you are saying is you need to be self-aware and connected to yourself to successfully connect with other people.
Or to go through the different layers.
Yeah.
So you can connect on a surface level with anyone, right?
Yeah, but you want to go deeper, usually.
Exactly. Yeah. And that could be your partner, it could be customers, it could be your co-founder, it could be your best friends, it could be
investor.
Your parents. So if someone is listening to this and they're like, oh, therapy sounds great, or it sounds like, I'm not sold yet, what are some things that they can do to maybe build awareness of their mental health and then start putting some things into action maybe before they commit to therapy?
Yeah, I think it's the self-reflection, really. It's like if you take a moment, it doesn't have to be in context of therapy, but anyone who's listening, if they take a moment to be like, okay, what am I doing? Why am I doing it? 5 years, 10 years, 15 years from now, where do I want to be, right? Which is like, it's more of a mindfulness exercise, which I believe we should all do, right? And sometimes we don't have any influence over the circumstances we are at for whatever reasons, but given all of those things, I can and cannot change. It's like, okay, what do I really want, right? And if you are true to yourself, you will start to see things that you want. And some of those things, or like you believe you're on the mission to do, right? Mm-hmm. That will be very often with founders. It's like they have this strong drive, like, no, I was made to do this, right? I believe that I'm in this world for this reason, right? Sometimes it happens. You will start to see that, okay, there are some blockers. There's like, I want this, but maybe I'm too shy or in the wrong place or this and that. And you will, if you think about those blockers, those are the first things that I would consider talking to someone about. Or another way is like you can just literally go and start like educating yourself, right? Which is also very interesting. There's a lot of materials about it. And being like, for example, if I am, let's say, neurodivergent and I'm maybe somewhere on the autism spectrum or Asperger, which personally I always believe it's a superpower, but that's a different story. I know that certain things are how I react to things are almost like completely independent, like how I want to react to them, right? It's like I process things in a different way. If you know how you process things, if you have the enough like understanding of your brain and your like mechanics in your body and your mind, you can actually start to use it, right? And be, rather than make it your blockers, it can be your superpower, right? And you can be like, or let's take, even like I was talking to someone recently about like the like super lows, like heavy depression and this kind of like dark moments. Like how many people use this as an inspiration for and drive for being like, no, I'm gonna actually make a big change and actually like use it as an inspiration to create something, right? So it's like really understanding of what you want to do, what are the blockers, and then work on yourself and finding the strength in yourself to actually work on it. And that's how I would start. And then at some point you may be like, I actually would benefit from somebody else. As one of our therapists on our platform says, Gavin, he says, you know, it's like borrowing somebody's cognitive capacity to process things, right? And that's a perfect way of framing it, right? Sometimes I don't need to go through therapy. I just need somebody else's perspective. And as a therapist, if you have a good therapist and like a good match, you can see them once a month. You can see them on demand. You can call them after 5 months and be like, hey, I really want to talk because I have something that I wanted to, you know, like just work on. And it's a confidential space, so you can talk to them about anything. Very often things that we cannot talk about to others, right? Let's say you're going through, let's say tomorrow you have to let go half of your team and today you are giving an interview. You have to be on top of your stuff, but you know what's going to happen and you are like super anxious inside. It's actually quite difficult to do it on your own, right? So those are the moments when you can go to your therapist and be like, hey, I'm going through this, help me. And your therapist can have 100% of knowledge because they are operating in a confidential space. So it can be like a very well used space for everyone. And I think it's a very, very powerful tool if seen this way.
And for those founders that love tracking and measurement, how can you measure progress in terms of mental health?
I mean, like there are, of course, like tools how it is done, like the clinical like forms where you can fill the form and then fill it like again after a month. Things like, okay, have you been like very anxious over the last few weeks and so on, which is an interesting way to do it. And I actually did an experiment with it with a group of founders at some point. Mm-hmm. And you could see how things change. But so that's like a one way of doing it. We will probably build a tool for this at some point. I will tell you when, but not now. And then the other way is like, really like, okay, how do you feel with yourself, right? If you wake up in the morning and you're like energetic, you're like, okay, I've got this, I'm going to do it. It's great. If you don't wake up like this, but you are able to get yourself to this state more or less throughout the day, that's also good. But if like at some point you are losing a little bit of this feeling of purpose and like knowing what you are doing and why, and you are not feeling good with yourself, that's probably like a, you know, like a negative on the scale. And then if people want to track it, it can be, well, there are tools like journaling, right? Like we even have like the things like Oura Rings or Whoop or whatever people are tracking. They can look at certain metrics of the quality of sleep. We usually know what affects our body, right? Stress affects our body in a different way. So you can choose one of those metrics and then you can start like taking note on like, okay, how do I feel? Checking in with yourself. And then if you actually do it like out of curiosity, after a few months, if you do it regularly, you can be like, this is going on like this, right? Or it's going on like this, or hopefully it's going on like this. I think the clinical ways of measuring therapy are there, but I don't find them that appealing, if that makes sense.
Mm. I don't find them very appealing either.
How do you measure your mental health?
I don't measure it very well at the moment. However, I'd say recently it's been worse than it has been for a while, maybe. And that's been a signpost to get back to my routines, which when I did them, it felt like I was most alive, like most on top of my game. And there have just been points over the past, let's say, 6 months where various things have just dropped off and I haven't picked them back up. And so at my peak, like tech bro habit stacking lifestyle, I was doing the whole 5 a.m. wake up, journaling, go for a walk outside, exercise 6 times a week, seeing friends, balanced lifestyle, healthy food, etc. Getting enough sleep. And now it's sort of, and like yoga and meditation and everything, pretty much. And now it's dropped back to very little. I still wake up early, but like I just go straight into working. And I haven't prioritized that first hour in the morning, or hour and a half to me, for quite a long time. So I haven't tracked it, but this is a very timely conversation because I'm going to start.
I think to what you're saying, and I think it's actually important, you know, we all have like those, like what you're describing is like, let's say maybe there are like 5 or 10 things that you do that you know create the routine for you and make you feel good. And then when things starts to be stressful, it's like first one goes, second one goes, third one goes. Yeah. And then suddenly you're left with all your bad habits, right? Because that's what our immediate reaction to when things are overwhelming, stressful, and we have more work and so on. And very often we start to feel bad because we don't have this routine. But the truth is, you just pick the first thing that's the easiest and start doing it again. Pick the second thing that's the easiest, start doing it again. And those small choices, it's almost like you're, it's the same as muscle memory, like your body memory, your like mind memory will start to recognize like, aha, I'm back, right? And the thing which I showed you like earlier with this like changes in aura ring, that's, for example, was exactly it. So what you're saying that you go straight to work. At some point I started doing it and I was like, no, okay, let's start with breathing, right? This is the easiest one for me. It like requires no effort. I'm just going to do like a few like a breath, like cycles. Okay. Immediately got me in the mood of like, oh, I want to do a bit of my yoga, which immediately got me in the mood of, which, you know, it's like a, it's a cycle of good habits.
Mm.
And sometimes people struggle because there's this like physical thing and physical health and the mental health. And sometimes people are like, oh, this whole like a mental journey is so hard, but it's maybe easier to start with like, okay, go for a walk. You start with the physical thing, the mental will follow, or start with mental, physical will follow. It's like, you know, those things are like connected, if that makes sense. It's like, go do the dishes. It's going to be the first step and it's already good. And it's like from that, you will do the next thing and the next thing and the next thing.
That is very sadly all we have time for. But this has been such a varied and very practical conversation, which I think is needed in this space. So thank you so much. It's been incredibly helpful. And it's a good reminder that I'm going to get back in touch with my therapist who I've had very intermittent calls with, and also get back to my routines, which I know will serve me, and start measuring them. So thank you.
Thanks for inviting me. And I think connecting with therapists is, if you have a good one, it's always a great